entities within this material world, he resides in his abode, restraining his anger and intolerance. Purport: Anantadeva's main mission is to dissolve this material creation, but he checks his anger and intolerance. This material world is created to give the conditioned souls another chance to go back home, back to Godhead, but most of them do not take advantage of this facility. After the creation, they again exercise their old propensity for lording it over the material world. These activities of the conditioned souls anger Anantadeva and his desires to destroy the entire world, to destroy the entire material world. Yet, because he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is kind toward us and checks his anger and intolerance. Only at certain times does he express his anger and destroy the material world. he's, you know, tolerant. Only sometimes he destroys the material world. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So Lord Sankarshan is the ocean of unlimited spiritual qualities, and thus he is known as Anantadeva. So that's how we came to understand the name Anantadeva. He's also called as Sankarshana. Why is he called as Sankarshana? It was mentioned before. Well, that wasn't the other. He said he holds the universes in place. Actually, the word Sankarshan is related a lot to gravity, I hear, from certain Hindus and so on. But that is Sankarshana. He draws together the enjoying jiva and the sense objects under the false egoistic conception of I am I, like that. And therefore, he's also known as Sankarshana. We're hearing here because he has unlimited spiritual qualities, he's known as Anantadeva. So these are different names for the same personality. He is non-different from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because we know that the first expansion of Krishna is Balaram, and then Balaram has his own expansions by which he manifests everything, spiritual and mundane. So although Krishna, we hear from the Bhagavad Gita, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, Mata Sarvam Pravartite, Krishna says that he is the source of the material and spiritual worlds. But Krishna himself does these things through his various personal expansions and shaktis. Krishna himself doesn't have to really do anything. So his first personal expansion, you can say an expansion of his personality, is Balaram. And this Balaram also expands himself to manifest everything spiritual and mundane. Balaram expands himself as the Mahasankarshana, who manifests the spiritual reality and the jivas there. And then there's further expansions as the three Purusha avatars. Collectively, they're called as Paramatma. So the word Paramatma refers to all three aspects of the Purusha avatars. You know the Purusha avatars, Mahavishnu, Garbhodakshay Vishnu, and Shirodakshay Vishnu. Together, they're called as Paramatma. Mahavishnu is called as the Paramatma of the aggregate universes. That means all the universes together. And Garbhodakshay Vishnu is called as the Paramatma of each individual universe, sometimes referred to as the soul of the universe, Garbhodakshay Vishnu. And Shirodakshay Vishnu is the Paramatma of the individual souls. He's residing within the heart. So the word Paramatma is actually one entity in three features. These are the Purusha avatars. So these Purusha avatars are also expansions of Balaram or Mahasankarshan. And then the last expansion is Anantadeva, which we're hearing about now. Anantadeva is also an expansion of Balaram. He's part of Balaram Tattva or Nityananda Tattva. And we're hearing here, for this reason, he's non-different from the personality of God. It's actually, according to the Lagu Bhagavatamrita, it seems that he's actually a Shakti Avesha avatar. Anyway, in a couple of verses, it will be described his service mentality towards the absolute truth. As we may have often heard, he's also known as Anantadeva because the unlimited glories of the Lord are always coming from his mouth. So although he's non-different from the Lord being an expansion, he is also a servant of Krishna. Somehow or other, it seems more weird when we hear about the Purusha avatars being servants of of Krishna. Like we say that the Purusha avatars have a service mentality towards Krishna. That seems more awkward, but when we say that Balaram has a service attitude towards Krishna, it seems perfectly okay. We were discussing this a little bit in Chaupati. Somehow there seems more weird to hear about like Narayana and the various Vishnu expansions having a service propensity towards, because they're also gods, so how is it that they have a service attitude towards God? But when we hear about Balaram having a service attitude, it's no big deal. It seems like it makes sense, and that's his brother, and so on. But these Vishnu expansions, Paramatma and so on, they're all expansions of Balaram. So Balaram is the root of the service ego. This is mentioned in the CC, that chapter 6 with Adi Lila. He's the root of the service ego. So his expansions, including the jivas, all the jivas are actually part of Balaram, Tattva. The jivas that are in Braja come directly from Balaram. This according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur's analysis in Jayavadharma. The jivas in the Vaikuntha come from the Mahasankarshan. And the jivas in the material world come from Mahavishnu. So this is mentioned in the by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And this is, of course, corroborated in the Bhagavad Gita itself. When Krishna speaks about his relationship to the jivas, those discussions are always about Paramatma. If you study the Bhagavad Gita chapter 13 or chapter 9 even, and so on. So they're all coming from, they're all aspects of this Balaram and Dhananda Tattva. And therefore, Anantadev, who's also an expansion, he's not indifferent from the personality of Godhead. He also has a service mentality towards the personality of Godhead, which is natural because he's an expansion of Balaram, who's the root of the Seva Abhimana, the service ego. And so he's always glorifying the Lord. He Anantadev, also expands himself in various ways to serve the personality of Godhead. He serves as his bed, as his shoes, as his brahmanas thread, etc. Many 10 different things are particularly mentioned. I don't remember all of them. So in this way, Anantadev is the personality of Godhead, non-different. At the same time, he's different because he has a Sevya Abhimana, or a Seva Abhimana, Sevaka Abhimana, or service mentality towards Krishna. And now we're hearing about his personality. Another aspect of his personality is mentioned here. For the welfare of all the entities within this material world, he resides in his abode, restraining his anger and tolerance. So Prabhupada comments in the purport primarily on this point, that his main mission is to dissolve the material creation. through this expansion of his personality, Krishna dissolves the material creation. But he does it at intervals. So he has to check his anger and intolerance. So the question comes up, why will he be angry or intolerant? Isn't the Lord all merciful and so on? But we're hearing from Srila Prabhupada here, the material world is a facility to give conditioned souls like us an opportunity to transcend the material existence and connect ourselves with the personality of Godhead. But oftentimes we do not take advantage of that opportunity. When Krishna releases the material energy which contains us at the beginning of creation, and we begin to act helplessly under the influence of our previous desires and impressions, it's called as anadi karma. Actually, it's coming up also. Anadi karma is beginningless impressions of enjoyment. And so when Mahavishnu releases the material energy, and, you know, he glances upon it, that glance contains the conditioned jivas and their karmas. And then once those karmas start to manifest, we begin to helplessly move under the current, if you will, of the karmic impressions. If you imagine karmic impressions like a strong current, I often give the image of, if you go to Haridwar, don't go to Haridwar, it's really, you know, Vrindavan, Mayapur, Bas, Jagannathpur, maybe right now. But if you can see a documentary, Haridwar there, the Ganga in Haridwar, the current is very strong. So strong is the current, they have placed chains, you know, poles with chains on it. So in order to take bath there, you have to hold on to the chain and dip in. If you let go, you'll end up in the Bay of Bengal. So similarly, the current of our karmic impressions are like a strong, it's very powerful, like that Ganga current in Haridwar. And so once Krishna releases the energy, as he describes in the Bhagavad Gita, what is it? Pakriti Swam Avashtabhya. Richard Jami Punapuna. As he releases the energy containing the jivas inside his Pakriti, then we begin to helplessly move under the those impressions. And therefore, although the material world is a facility to transcend it ultimately, just as you might take wood from a tree to chop it down, this analogy is given, although that's a facility for that, oftentimes being helplessly moved by the impressions of our previous karma, we don't take advantage of the opportunity. So an aspect of Krishna's personality is that he gets frustrated to see that. He's provided good opportunity, good facility for transcendence, and we don't take advantage of it. And so sometimes he gets upset and just destroys the material world in order to make a point. An aspect, someone asked me, why does Krishna do that last week or something? And we're discussing because that way we can more greatly appreciate the ephemeral nature of matter. And ultimately, that appreciation accumulated over many lifetimes may lead to inquiry about how to transcend it. And so we're hearing that Anantadev, he restrains his anger, but at intervals he does destroy the material world, frustrated or angry with the conditioned entities moving under, not taking advantage of the facilities of material existence for transcending it. So this is an aspect of Krishna's personality, Anantadev being an expansion of his personality. Here's an aspect of God's personality. Therefore, we find that aspect in us also, in the sense that we also find ourselves frustrated with individual entities when we give them some facility and they don't take advantage of it. We often may find ourselves frustrated to see that. So, jamadi asya yataha, everything is coming ultimately from the absolute truth. So this is also an aspect of his personality, seeing that he's provided facility for something wonderful, but we don't take advantage of it. He becomes angry and destroys it. So that's this verse from what I can see and Prabhupada's discussed. Are there any questions, comments, concerns on this particular point? Points? Sure. No, not exactly. I'm not very aware of Avatar Katha in a great detail. It's discussed in great detail in chapter 20 of the Madhya Lila. But the idea is that Krishna has Balaram will expand. There's a first Chaturvyuha consisting of Vasudeva, Sankarshan, Pradumna, Aniruddha. Then there's a second Chaturvyuha. And then from the second expansions of Chaturvyuha, the Paramatma comes, Mahavishnu, etc., from Sankarshan, like that. So I'm not greatly, I don't remember all the details of that, but they're I don't understand them to be exactly like expansions of Sankarshan, like they, Aniruddha, Pradumna expand from Sankarshan. I don't understand it like that. I don't know exactly, I would have to check that out for clarity. Yeah, Madhya Lila chapter 20. But we know that there's a Chaturvyuha, there's a four expansions that come from Balaram. The Chaturvyuha, and then they have their further expansions like that. Oh, you are reading that chapter. Yeah, that's not an easy chapter to traverse, so we can maybe go through it together. So, any other questions, comments about this purport, this particular point? Anantadeva, his anger, destroying the material world because we're not responsibly using it. No? Okay. Yeah. Is there a time?
Yeah, is it like basically when Kali Yuga ends, is that when he destroys material creation?
Krishna says, Kalpa Shaya Punas. Tani kalpa do rishajami aham. At the end of the kalpa, so the kalpa means at the end of Lord Brahma's life, then there's destruction of the whole cosmos. At the end of Brahma's day, there's a partial destruction that takes place. That is also facilitated by Anantadev. At the end of Lord Brahma's life, there's a complete destruction of the cosmos. And then at the beginning, It's manifested again by Krishna. So I don't know how Brahma's life is for 311 trillion years. So like that.
I was just asking because I got confused about. I know Krishna's last incarnation, Kalki.
Yeah.
He comes and shows all the beings, but I.
Yeah, that's on a more micro level.
I see.
Because the four yugas only are experienced on the Earth planet. It's not like there's Kali Yuga in the whole universe. There's not Kali Yuga going on in Swargaloka or Mahaloka or Tapaloka or even the Bula Swarga. The four yuga cycles are specifically experienced only on the Earth planet. So Kalki's coming down to destroy living entities is on a micro level. It's only happening on the Earth planet. It's not like he travels throughout the cosmos destroying living entities, but only on the Earth planet. And what we're hearing about is on a more cosmic level, cosmic destruction. Yeah.
Last question. I don't know. When I was reading the description of Bhagavatam, since Kalki is an expansion of Krishna.
He's a Shaktivesh avatar.
Oh, I see. So even all the souls he basically, the bodies he destroyed, they don't get liberated.
I don't know. To be honest with you, I'm not exactly sure at this point because Krishna's expansion is unique. When Krishna kills, all the entities get liberation. I don't know if the same is true of all the avatars of Krishna. I'm not clear, to be honest with you. I would have to check that out. I don't think it is the case, though.
Okay, yeah,
because
otherwise,
it's a special feature of Krishna's form that when he kills, they get liberation. When other forms of Vishnu kill, they get liberated from that body. But I don't know if they actually get liberation from the material existence. like that. I'll have to double check that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Raktakuru. So.
Hare Krishna. Is there more than, like when you say the Earth planet, is there like a universe of Earth planets or just one Earth planet?
Well, we were hearing in this canto about the Bhumandala plane. So Earth seems to stretch, when the word Earth is used, it seems to be more than just this Earth planet that we're thinking of, but it seems to discuss like a whole plane.
Okay.
If you were to consider like different planes of being, then there's the Bhumandala plane. Mm-hmm. And all of that is Earth. And it stretches beyond this planet. But I think generally in a practical sense, we think of Earth as the Earth planet as such. So that's what I can share on that particular point. Like I said, I don't usually get too much into these particular elements because the real thing is we got to transcend it. Knowing the geography is, of course, nice, I suppose. It's in the Bhagavatam after all. Yeah.
Can you just refresh your memory? There's two different types of devastation.
Yes, the one at the end of Brahma's life and one at the end of Brahma's day. Those are there's actually four the types difference. Of destructions that are discussed in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam. But generally, I think we hear about it in terms of these two types of destruction at the end of Brahma's day, at the end of Brahma's life. The other two types of destruction, I think, is the gradual destruction of the body at every moment, and then the destruction at the when you get liberation from the material existence. Don't quote me on that. There's a clear chapter in the 12th canto that discusses that. Well, at the end of Brahma's day, the destruction is only half of the universe. The fire comes up from Anantadev, I believe this is the description, and it devastates all the lower planetary systems and Earth also, and all the way up to Swargaloka, or maybe Swarga also. And then in the higher planetary systems, Mahartapa, Jana, like that, the fires are felt, and so they all flee to Satyaloka because they can feel the heat of the destruction, although their planets aren't destroyed. I don't know. And then when he wakes up, he has to again manifest those regions which were destroyed at his nighttime, at the beginning of his day. And then in the end of Brahma's life, there's a complete, the only word that's coming to mind is sucking in, but this is absorption. of the material, of the whole cosmic manifestation within the Mahavishnu, like that. So those are the different types of destructions there, referred to as avyaktas. Both are called as avyakta, or unmanifest. Yeah, something like 4.32 billion years. It's 311 trillion years. I don't know what's the timing about it, but the jiva's going to a state of susupti, which is like deep sleep. So however long it is, you won't experience as such. Just like when sometimes when you deep sleep, you wake up and you only feel like a few minutes have passed sometimes, and it could be many hours have actually passed by. But you may experience it as only a few minutes when you go deep under. It's like when they give you an anesthetic or something, if you have to do surgery. You may not feel like you've been under for very long, but you may have been under for many hours. So when the prakriti is drawn into Krishna, along with the conditioned jivas, the jivas enter into a state of susupti, which is like deep sleep. And I don't know how long they stay underneath it, but the experience probably will be as if no time has passed at all. And then there's, again, manifestation. This is going on forever. This has been going on since time eternal, like that. Anything else? Any other points? Yeah.
Krishna is Krishna form. You're all planets and below a planet?
I don't think so. Krishna's got a little style. Or let's say he's got standards. Generally we hear Krishna only, he appears in the earth region of the Bhumandal plane and all the various universes. Therefore, earth is glorified above other planetary systems because of Krishna's appearance there. Along with his Vrindavan Dham and so on. So, no, he doesn't usually. Of course, there is a discussion about some of him traveling to Shvetadvipa, which is the abode of the Paramatma, Mahavishnu, because Mahavishnu wanted to see him, along with Arjuna. But he doesn't usually travel to the lower planetary systems, or even the upper planetary systems, but rather the Earth planet.
Why is the Earth planet
so special? Good question. Why is the Earth planet so special? Maybe because we live on it. At least that might be what we're thinking. To be honest with you, I can't think of a Shastric statement other than the fact that Krishna appears. Well, they're holy. Well, other places, like the upper planetary systems, those places are also filled with forms of Godhead. That's what when we read the Brihadbhagavatamrita, they have many beautiful forms of Godhead that they're serving there also. Although their mentality is one of enjoyment, at least in Swarga, but in the higher systems like Mahaloka, Janaloka, they're all like sages and renunciates and yogis and people who are deeply absorbed in spiritual life. Well, not like Vrindavan, of course. Yeah, no. Well, even when he comes to the Earth planet, he brings Vrindavan Dham with him. You know, he manifests Vrindavan Dham with him. So, I don't know if that exactly... I would have to look into it, to be honest with you. The higher planetary systems are like high levels of motive goodness, which is sacred. I mean, they do sacred activities there, like worship the Lord and so on. Any place where the Lord is worshipped, in one sense, is a holy dham. We hear that any place where the Lord is glorified or worshipped, or wherever devotional service is being performed anyway, that place becomes a holy place by dint of that devotional service. So in the higher regions, above Swargaloka, they are all worshipping Vishnu in some form, either within the mind or there are forms of Vishnu that they worship with 1,000 arms and so on. So those places, by dint of that worship, are certainly sacred, undoubtedly, high levels of motive goodness. So I think this is a good question to investigate. I think we just always just took it for granted that Earth is just special, you know. It is what it is. But I mean, one answer that came to mind that we often hear is because the level of enjoyment on the Earth planet is not acute, you know, in other words, very intense, nor is that suffering very intense, just like a balance. In the higher regions or the lower regions, the enjoyment or suffering, respectively, are very intense, and that makes it practically nearly impossible to focus on the absolute truth. And therefore, Earth planet becomes a very fertile ground for focus on the absolute, because the mixture of the two experiences are doable, and it allows for room for other sorts of meditation and focus. That was one, you know, but as far as like a very strict Shastric answer, I don't know. I can't think of anything right now. So I'll have to investigate it. Why is the Earth planet so special? You know, generally people think it's that this such a understanding is just due to our human narcissism. That because we're humans, we live on the Earth planet, therefore it is very special, and so on. We don't want them to think that, so we need to find. I'll look it up, a very deep Shastric answer. Otherwise, it's just my sense of it right now. Okay, anything else? No, I can stop here. I was going to go on because there's only 8. There's not many verses in this chapter, only 15. I thought I could finish it, but I don't think I can do it now. Should I go on? Should I stop here? Okay, next verse. Shukadeva Goswami continued, the demigods, the demons, the Udragas, serpentine demigods, the Siddhas, the Gandharvas, the Vidyadharas, and many highly elevated sages constantly offer prayers to the Lord because he is intoxicated. The Lord looks bewildered, and his eyes appearing like flowers in full bloom move to and fro. He pleases his personal associates, the heads of the demigods, by the sweet vibrations emanating from his mouth. Dressed in bluish garments and wearing a single earring, he holds a plow on his back with his two beautiful and well-constructed hands. Like I said, Ananta Dev has two forms, it appears, one like a serpent and one like a human. So the descriptions are going back and forth. Appearing as white as the heavenly king Indra, he wears a golden belt around his waist and a Vaijayanti garland over fresh tulsi blossoms around his neck. Bees, intoxicated by the honey-like fragrance of the tulsi flowers, hum very sweetly around the garland, which thus becomes more and more beautiful. In this way, the Lord enjoys his very magnanimous pastimes. Yay for the Lord. Next verse. If persons who are very serious about being liberated from material life, already disqualification, anyway, hear the glories of Ananta Dev from the mouth of a spiritual master in the chain of disciplic succession, and if they always meditate upon Sankarsana, the Lord enters the cores of their hearts, vanquishes all the dirty contamination of the material modes of nature, and cuts to pieces the hard knot within the heart, which has been tied tightly since time immemorial by the desire to dominate material nature through fruitive activities. Mm-hmm. We're just looking at a little word here. Narada Muni, the son of Lord Brahma, always glorifies Anantadeva in his father's assembly. There he sings blissful verses of his own composition, accompanied by his string instrument or celestial singer known as Tumburu. So Tumburu can refer to a string instrument or a celestial singer. Purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. None of these descriptions of Lord Anantadev are imaginary. They are all transcendentally blissful and full of actual knowledge. However, unless one hears them directly from a bona fide spiritual master, in the line of the disciplic succession, one cannot understand them. This knowledge is delivered to Narada by Lord Brahma. And the great saint Narada, along with his companion Tumburu, distributes it all over the universe. Sometimes the Supreme Personality of Godhead is described as Uttama Shloka, one who is praised by beautiful poetry. Narada composes various poems to glorify Lord Ananta, and therefore the word Samshlokayam Asa, praised by selective poetry, is used in this verse. The Vaishnavas in the Gaudiya Sampradaya belong to the disciplic succession stemming from Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is the spiritual master of Narada. Narada is the spiritual master of Vyasudeva, and Vyasudeva wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam as a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Therefore, all devotees in the Gaudiya Sampradaya accept the activities of Lord Ananta related in the Srimad Bhagavatam as authentic, and they are thus benefited by going back home, back to Godhead. The contamination in the heart of a conditioned soul is like a huge accumulation of garbage created by the three modes of material nature, especially the modes of rajas, passion, and tamas, ignorance. This contamination becomes manifest in the form of lusty desires and greed for material possessions, as confirmed herein. Unless one receives transcendental knowledge in the Supa succession, there is no question of his becoming purified of this contamination. So this purport, this is a long translation, but the purport is basically describing Ananta Dev, how we understand his position, and why one might not understand his position. So Ananta Dev's position is transcendental, adokshaja. Adokshaja means it's beyond material sense perception. So how do you understand something beyond material sense perception? There's only one way to understand it, and that's by hearing. The interesting thing about that is that hearing is also sense. So we say that, you know, understanding transcendence is beyond material sense perception, but hearing is a sense. And we say it can be understood by hearing. So how is that? So how is it the case? I didn't think to mention this point, but it's coming up somehow or other. So how is it the case that hearing with our apparently our mundane ear allows for us to understand something that's transcendental beyond the mundane atmosphere? It's a good question. It comes up in the Bhagavatam also in chapter 87 of the 10th canto, where Parashit Maharaj has heard the majority of Krishna Leela. And he poses the question, hey, wait a minute, Krishna's beyond the modes of material nature. So, and I just heard about him with my ears, which is a composition of the modes of material nature. And you just spoke about him with your tongue, which is also composed of the modes of material nature. And Krishna's beyond the modes of material nature. So how is it that I was able to hear that? And you were able to speak it? Sometimes we find these groups that mention that God is beyond words, he's beyond thought, etc. And such idea means that we should just go and speak and thinking about our nonsense. Because if God is beyond thought and beyond speech, then you can't talk about him, you can't think about him. And therefore, what can I talk and think about? Mainly the mundane world, which I have experience of, the modes of material nature. Which is, by the way, compared to the garbage. And our experience is compared to a trash dump, which is holding all the garbage. The garbage of the modes of material nature, according to the verse here. By the way, so anyway, how is it? So Parashit Maharaj asks this question. It's a very good question, actually. How, if God is infinite and beyond matter, how can anyone infinitesimal and within matter understand him? So the answer that is given is kind of cryptic. The answer that is given, in short, is that if you didn't have senses, mind, and intelligence, you wouldn't even be able to understand this material world. This material world would be as incomprehensible as God, without senses, mind, and intelligence. So this is the type of answer that is given. It's like, how the heck does that answer the question? Oftentimes, we have that experience reading the verses. How is that an answer to the question? He said, God is beyond matter. He's infinite. How can someone infinitesimal and within matter understand him? And he says, without mind, senses, and intelligence, you couldn't even understand the material world. So the idea that is expressed in short is that by whose mercy do you have senses, mind, intelligence by which you can even comprehend matter? Because without senses, mind, intelligence, even the material world would be totally incomprehensible. We actually comprehend, we comprehend and experience this world through the gross and subtle bodies, you know, senses, mind, intelligence, etc., even ego. Because you need a reference point to experience the material world, a certain conceptual orientation to experience matter. So we're experiencing the world through gross and subtle bodies, actually. So how do we come to get those gross and subtle bodies? So the basic point is that by Krishna's mercy, one is given empowerment to understand even the gross world and subtle world by one's gross and subtle bodies. So also by Krishna's mercy, you can understand something transcendental and infinite by his mercy. That's the basic message of the chapter. And then it goes into this real detailed philosophical discussion by the personified Vedas. So the idea is that God, although this is a sense, and God is beyond the senses can be empowered to understand God by God's mercy. That's essentially the point. And that empowerment, of course, in short, is bhakti. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, bhakti amam abhijananti, yavan yash chashmi tattvataha. One can understand me in tattva by how? By bhakti. By bhakti you can come to understand me. So what happens is that with the fire of bhakti, just like when you stick an iron rod in fire, that iron rod assumes the quality of fire. And therefore it assumes the ability to burn things just as fire has the ability to burn things. So also by the fire of bhakti yoga, one's senses assume the nature of bhakti. And by that bhakti you can comprehend Krishna. So it's a very simple point. So therefore, how do I get connection with that bhakti? So bhakti, in other words, is a completely spiritual thing. Bhakti is the type of bhakti that gives pratyaksha avagamam. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that bhakti gives direct perception of reality through one's senses. It is not that it's just a feeling. Spiritual life is not just a feeling, but it's an actual direct experience of the truth with one's senses, spiritualized senses, senses that are spiritualized by bhakti. So this bhakti that gives these greater levels of realization is understood to be a combination of two of Krishna's internal potencies, namely the Samvit Shakti and the Hadini Shakti. Samvit Shakti means the cognitive potency that gives awareness of spiritual existence. And Hadini Shakti is a potency that gives the blissful experience, the spiritual experience, of spiritual life. So this bhakti is a combination of those two potencies. So the Samvit Shakti reveals the nature of the absolute truth. Are you understanding, following? So this bhakti is ultimately a transcendental potency, and so it's compared to fire. And when the more we keep ourselves in the fire, the more our senses assume the same nature as bhakti. And thus is able to comprehend Krishna. So it is a sense, but it begins by the hearing process, the understanding of the absolute truth. And so what's being pointed out here, you have to hear from those in the succession. In other words, you have to hear from those who are themselves empowered by bhakti. Otherwise, you hear from those who are not doing bhakti, then whatever they speak is simply a mental speculation. Oftentimes it is the case. Although even if they quote Bhagavad Gita, it'll be usually from a speculative platform. They'll have their own purport to it. This you'll find all the time, everywhere, where people have their own purport to the Bhagavad Gita. You know, there's what Bhagavad Gita actually says, and then there's their purport to it. Therefore, Prabhupada felt the need to write a Bhagavad Gita as it is, because everyone had their own version of Bhagavad Gita. A Bhagavad Gita as I want it to be, or Bhagavad Gita as I see it. Bhagavad Gita according to my opinion. Even Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, according to my opinion. So there's room for opinion, right? They think in this way, and so Prabhupada felt the need to write the Bhagavad Gita as it is. By connecting oneself to those whose own senses and mind and intelligence and ego has been completely spiritualized by bhakti, then by connection to them, our gross and subtle body, senses, mind, intelligence, and ego also can become purified. In other words, they help us to enter into the fire, and they help us to keep us there, by which we can also understand transcendence progressively. And so this purport is being established that the activities of Ananta Day are accepted by the followers of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And the reason they're accepted is because authorities who themselves have bhakti have helped us to enter into the fire of bhakti and understand it. When I was in Chalpati on Nityananda Chayodasi, His Holiness Devamrita Maharaj was there, and he spoke very nicely about how, and if you see chapter 5 of the Adi Lila, which deals with Nityananda Tattva, it deals with how Nityananda is the expansion of the whole cosmos and so on. So he was mentioning how every religion seems to have this idea of a cosmic God or some type of cosmic understanding of the absolute truth, and so on. He was explaining this way very nicely. And then he explained that, he said, the fact that we believe all this is certainly indeed the mercy of Nityananda. Which I thought was a beautiful point, because he was describing Lord Nityananda's mercy. And he said, the fact that we could believe all this, there's a Mahavishnu, when he breathes out, pores are coming. Then he expands Garbhalakshay Vishnu. He enters into the universe. And then a lotus leaf comes from his navel. And then out of that lotus flower, there's a four-headed creature named Brahma. And from his mind, he creates all sorts of, they're called progenitors. And they have like human forms, but they're the source of all animals and beasts and reptiles, even though they have human forms. So he was describing that the fact that we could actually believe all this is indeed the mercy of Nityananda. And there's no other explanation for it. In other words, my point is that by mercy, one comes to have connection to the absolute truth. And then by empowerment, one comes to perceive it, right? By mercy, you come to establish some faith in it, that this is not just far out in imagination. I mean, this, you know, no, even someone on DMT and all these types of hallucinogen drugs that we were hearing about yesterday couldn't imagine such a thing. Usually when they're on these drugs, what do they imagine? That I'm one with God, that I'm God. They see the material world kind of break down before them, and they have a sense of an existence beyond matter. But never have you ever heard anyone on these drugs talk about a Mahavishnu expanding universes from their pores, the entering as a Garbhalakshay, and such great detail also how the universe unfolds from the subtle elements to the gross elements and so on. It's a very detailed description. It's hard to imagine that anyone could just imagine these things with such great detail. And also consistency, at least philosophically consistent. You know, as God is the efficient cause of the universe. You know, when Acharya Nisha shared this information at a UIC a few weeks ago, there was one newcomer that had come to the program. And when she heard this, you know, she was like, what the hell? And she reported them to the school, said that they're a cult and they bring Bhakti Shan there to show us what we're supposed to be, you know, and all these things. So this is not, of course it is far out information. I was sharing with Acharya Nisha, you could have just expressed it in a more perhaps philosophical language. You could say, we believe that God is the efficient cause of the universe. In other words, he's a conscious agent that's brought the universe into being. And that, you know, there's room for, that's a very plausible explanation. Because the explanation of the atheists of the mature world is an explanation in terms of mechanism. So that doesn't cancel out an explanation in terms of agency. And it's reasonable to think that because unconscious things don't bring themselves into being. Conscious entities bring things into being. So it's certainly philosophically plausible that we accept God as the efficient cause of the universe. And then they say, well, what's your conception of God? Well, there's Mahavishnu, and then we can go into it, you know. But and although as far out as it sounds, millions of people have been thinking this for, you know, for us, millions of years, at least for as long as they've been aware of their tradition, they've been thinking this way. So it's quite possible. It's quite reasonable, at least. But the fact that Westerners like us can even take it as a serious consideration is certainly mercy. It's the mercy of connection with a bona fide disciple succession. By that connection, they give us faith. Because we say, okay, they're intelligent individuals. They're not just like stupid, and they seem to see this is certainly very viable, you know. It's like if you read Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's work, for example, you know, he wasn't a stupid individual. His English, we have a hard time comprehending. Oftentimes we have his work here in a dictionary here, and to go through one page takes 1 hour. So he wasn't an unintelligent individual, and there are many intelligent individuals who accept these far-out explanations. So we began to have that connection by mercy of the civil succession. They're able to; they have empowerment to instill faith, and then with that faith, with that initial investment—I like to call it an initial investment of faith—then through further empowerment of continued hearing process, we gain spiritualized mind, senses, ego, etc., by which we become to have direct perception of that reality. Pratyaksha avagaman. Pavitram idam uttamam. Krishna describes this bhakti as also pavitram idam uttamam, that it's the supreme purifier of purifiers. So then the second half of this purport discusses why we come to not understand the absolute reality. And it's due to the garbage the garbage bags of material experience, which blocks our ability to perceive and also to appreciate things that are beyond our experience jurisdiction. The toad in the well is the classic example of Srila Prabhupada. We often find it hard to believe things which are beyond our experience or experience jurisdiction even. Like spiritual reality, for example. That's beyond our ability to experience even with telescopes and so on, our senses. So sometimes, due to the experience of the modes of material nature, we find it hard to appreciate anything that could be beyond the modes of material nature. And therefore, we find it difficult to trust the process which can help us gain that experience, which is complete self-surrender and so on, to modify the succession and following the process, etc. We find that very difficult because there can't be anything beyond my experience, right? Obviously, I've experienced a whole lot of what there is to be experienced, right? That, of course, no one will actually come out and say that, but when it comes to transcendence, that's the stance they're actually taking. That is not possible because it's beyond my experience. And it's beyond my ability to even experience from where I stand now. You know, and, well, if it's true, then you should be able to prove it to me right now. You know, this is kind of very emotional, and I think this is a very intelligent stance oftentimes. It's highly emotional. You should be able to show me right now, you know, where's the evidence, like on-demand evidence for or transcendental reality. But if they had to understand like some biological finding or something of that sort, you need to have so much qualification to understand the evidence, the proof. It's not that you can give on-demand evidence. You know, if it's something you've discovered some rare finding in biology, you're not going to go show it to a layman in the street. How can he appreciate it? He says, "Well, I want on-demand evidence." Well, I have the on-demand evidence in one sense, but you're unqualified to even penetrate into it. You need some prerequisites. That of course, people will accept that enough, but when it comes to transcendence, they find it difficult. This, of course, is due to our beginningless experience of material existence. So we find it hard to surrender ourselves to a process that gives understanding of transcendence, which is unfortunate because the result is usually repeated birth and death. It means that we remain provincial in our understanding of life. Provincial means we remain thinking that this is all in all. So therefore you can't transcend it. If this is our conception, then you don't transcend, because you don't have a conception of transcendence to transcend it. And so the importance of this simple succession is expressed here, and understanding matters of transcendence, and also why we don't tend to understand it is also expressed by saying we're contaminated by mundane experience, actually. Although mundane experience seems to be, I'm not counting out that aspect of our being. That's an important aspect of our being. We experience the world, and that should be there. But it often tends to serve as a chain that tends to lock people down from higher level of experiences. In the same way that a person becomes bound by a particular upadhi, I'm a brahmachari, or I'm a grihastha, or I'm a sannyasi, and being so upadhi, then they feel that they have to put on a facade, or they have to live up to a certain, you know, quota, status quo, or have to fit in with a certain sort of ethos, otherwise everything will fall apart. So in the same way we become bound by upadhis, false designations of variegated sources, in the same way we become contaminated by our mundane experience. You know, we think that, oh, it's all fun and games. And it is fun and games until the next body, and the next body, and the next body. It means that the experience itself tends to work as a chain by making us provincial, thinking that this is all in all in existence, and that there can be nothing beyond it, and there'll be, even if there was something beyond it, you can know it anyway, you know, the agnostic sort of, so-called agnostic position and so on. And that's why transcendence is a great challenge for living entities who are conditioned for a long time. Like that, so these two points, these three elements are brought out in this particular purport. Anyone want to say anything on this? Any discussion on these particular points? Yeah, the microphone is.
Well, thank you for the class. That was really good. Not that I know what good is, really, though. But I was, the last point you were making about provincial, that was really interesting. I, something I just thought of how to perhaps encapsulate it is how just simply by experience you become addicted to experience.
Sure.
And I see that a lot of my friends, it's like, it's almost like not good enough to actually find the absolute truth.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much, there's unlimited things to experience. So why stop when someone says the door's right here, you know, when there's so many doors to walk into, you know, even if you walked into this one, it's like they don't, there's a need to know everything,
mm-hmm.
or to not even know everything, but really just experience everything.
Yeah.
Which and is so possible. Sometimes it's turned around to where you're not open-minded because you haven't gone and done
experience everything.
Yeah, exactly. So the experience yeah. binds you because you're it's like this meant you get this bodily designation of I'm the seeker. I'm seeking, you know. I actually can't find anything, but I'm just continually seeking.
Yeah, like that. We were hearing that a friend of mine was saying that Prabhupada said one time, everyone is saying I'm a seeker, but you should also find something. I like that. We were hearing the other day, yesterday, Prabhupada was describing about how the denizens of the spiritual relationship with Ananta Day, they have all the same types of experiences on a transcendental platform that we would experience in the month. Prabhupada was discussing how they were massaging the arms of Ananta Day and they felt Cupid strike their heart. And so he says, so there's nothing lacking in spiritual experience, but it's the basic difference is the eternal versus the ephemeral. So we become addicted to the ephemeral. In other words, we become addicted to misery. We're addicted to misery, believe it or not. Although in the initial stage of this experience is bliss, or at least nice, or at least that feels good, you know. And again, I'm saying there's nothing wrong with it, because that is, in the sense that is natural as such. We will have an experience in the material world. But the problem is that when those objects start to manifest their temporary nature, then it culminates in grief. Oftentimes it is the case. Unless people are actually really transcended internally, then their attachment to the ephemeral objects culminates in grief. That's the message of chapter 1 of Bhagavad Gita, that consciousness being attached to matter culminates in vishada, or vishada yoga. It culminates in despondency. And when you're attached to eternal objects, then there is no grief because the objects remain as such, perfect and ever fresh and festival for the mind, and all sorts of goody descriptions are given in the shastras. So I like that we become addicted to mundane experience, such as our, so that then our lot becomes suffering, just like a person addicted to drugs. Even though the drugs are destroying his body, he remains addicted. Nice. Any other points? Anyone wants to bring up any other elements? There's about 5 minutes. Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know. I have to look that up. Are Shaktivesh avatars in an eternal position? My sense of it is yes, because Narada Muni is considered a Shaktivesh avatar of bhakti. The Kumaras are considered Shaktivesh avatars of jnana. Prithu Maharaj is considered Shaktivesh avatar of the Palana Shakti, the maintenance potency of the Lord. And these are spiritual potencies, so I my sense of it would be yes, but I have to look it up to be total. Yeah, where is the confusion?
Well, just because we understand that it's an empowered jiva.
Yeah.
So sometimes we hear that, but we hear descriptions of the personality of Godhead, the Lord
yeah.
in his form. So
yeah.
it's hard for us to sometimes reconcile, okay, he's a jiva, but he's acting in the capacity of God, but isn't he still a jiva? But if it's an eternal thing, then that means by constitution,
yeah.
he's empowered with that potency of God. So he's
yes.
not exactly like a jiva in the sense of another jiva.
Yes.
He's a unique.
It's like Guru Tattva, for example. Guru is generally also a jiva. But we don't see him as such. We don't see Guru as Jiva Tattva. We see Guru as Guru Tattva. And he's Jiva plus the Guru Tattva, plus the empowerment of Krishna. So when we hear from the Guru, we hear the delegation of Krishna. We don't just hear Jiva. When we hear Jivas, we take it or leave it. And when we hear Guru, once we're surrendered, when you hear Guru, there's only taking it. that time, because you don't see just Guru, you see the delegation of Krishna, you know, Jiva plus something special. Yeah, so that's true. That's nice. Yeah.
Well, I heard that from in a lecture that His Holiness Sridhananda Maharaj was saying that Prabhupada once said that Hitler is also Shakti Vaishavatar.
I heard that too. We had a real fired up discussion about that. Hitler was a Shakti Vaish. I don't know if he used the word avatar though, because avatar means one who descends from the spiritual world to the material world. But we did hear that Hitler was a Shakti Vaish. You know, he was empowered by a Shakti of the Lord, probably like the destruction Shakti or something. Anyway, maybe that's not so funny, but I find it kind of humorous. Anyway, we had a real fired up discussion about this point about 3 or 4 years ago with Mother Donna Kaylee, and she also mentioned this point that she said she personally heard it in a lecture, Prabhupada say this, and devotees got real fired up because it was so far out. But the idea is that there's like, one can be empowered with Shakti, and that empowerment has to be acknowledged. Just like when the Nawab Hussein Shah bust in on Sanatana Goswami, falsely calling him sick, and he busts into his house, and it's like 30 Brahmins around there all discussing Bhagavatam and great bliss and happiness. And Nawab Hussein Shah, what is this? Are you supposed to be sick? And then Sanatana Goswami is like, yeah, I'm not going back in. At that time, Prabhupada comments that when the Nawab Hussein Shah walked into the room, they all stood up and gave him the honor because he was having the position or the opulence of an absolute as the manager of the district, and which is a certain, it's an opulence. And that opulence is ultimately coming from God. So they acknowledged him as embodying that opulence to a small degree. So in a similar way, it seems it could be acknowledged that he's possessing, Hitler, was possessing a particular sort of empowerment by which, and ultimately everything is going on by the will of God, the good and the bad, and the so-called good and bad, because really good and bad is in context of our false egos. But the so-called good and bad is all happening by the will of God ultimately. God is the ultimate doer of everything. And therefore, some entity can be empowered for a certain type of activity. But I don't know if Srila Acharya Dev said avatar, if Prabhupada said the word avatar, because the word avatar, that could be really interesting discussion. Because avatar means one who descends from the spiritual to the material plane. But maybe he was Shakti Vaish, he had empowerment for a particular thing that needed to happen at a particular time in history, like that. I hope this, anyway. It's recorded, whatever. Okay, any other points? Any other? Okay, then. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Just an announcement for, we're actually having our MSF today for March. We're doing something unique. We're going down to the train station at Jackson and State. We're going to be leaving from the temple at 10:15 sharp. So everyone please meet us in the lobby around 10. Get